Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. This series is about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. As a reminder, the Free Church was started in 1884 when 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel to the Congolese, start churches, educate and train up leaders to continue with the work of the church autonomously. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. Much of the early work had helped establish a functioning mission, but much happened during my family's tenure. So I felt that sharing the journey from the very beginning, as well as stories of all those that passed away during the effort, was important. Furthermore, there is a lot of information and history that will be shared that has never been heard or documented, and I'm glad to have captured it to preserve it for future generations. This is episode 2 of 7. The first episode told the story of the commencement of the Free Church mission work starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson. The work faced considerable challenges. It included governmental red tape, colonial influences, the heat and climate, slow communications, health issues, lack of medical care, and lack of doctors, resulting in many missionaries or their children succumbing to disease and sickness. Identifying property for new mission stations, securing the land, clearing said land, constructing buildings, including homes, schools, hospitals, and churches, was a long and tough journey, especially in the 1920s and 1930s. Communications were extremely slow between the field and the states. Construction materials were hard to come by and transport, and travel was very slow and challenging. Yet the pioneers worked hard, showed patience, and persevered to have established 3 functioning mission stations by 1936. In this episode, we will share about several more mission station sites being selected and started, as well as several children and adults that died during the period from 1936 to 1947.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
The church was being established, schools were in force, and some medical work was being done. The field staff recognized the need and opportunity for medical work in the area, and so that became one of the main efforts. However, remember that in 1936, the Great Depression was still in force, and this meant limited funds to support missionaries on the field. Meanwhile, 3 mission stations had been established, and funds and staffing were very thin. So the Evangelical Free Church reached out to the Evangelical Covenant Church, as they'd expressed interest in establishing a permanent mission in the Belgian Congo. Furthermore, the Free Church and Covenant Churches shared heritage from the 1800s, going back to their Swedish roots. The Covenant had already sent a few folks to Congo, but a permanent mission effort wasn't established, nor did they have official recognition by the Belgian government. So not having enough staff to operate the 3 missions effectively, the Free Church and the Covenant Church signed an agreement to sell Karawa to the Covenant Mission. The deal was signed on June 26, 1937. The price for the land, infrastructure, and some equipment was $5,000. So now there were 2 mission groups to cover the Ubangi area. Shared resources and staffing would ensue for many years between the Free Church and Covenant as the work grew and expanded. Together, they weathered turmoil in the country, politics, and the passing of the baton of responsibility to the Congolese to run their churches, schools, and hospitals. In January 1939, a request was made for Bado to be a mission station. Arthur Skoglund, Sigurd Westberg, Dr. Wally Thornbloom, and a Congolese nurse went to scope it out. They chose a site and were given a 25-hectare, or 62-acre, concession from the local tribal chief, Bokecha. He was an old man and had never learned to read and was blind as well. However, he signed the papers with his thumbprint. A formal application was made to the state. A temporary approval was granted on July 2, 1939. However, occupancy was temporarily limited to just 1 acre of the property. Art Lumblad was initially assigned to the station. Work started in February 1940. The old chief, Bokecha, had his people clear the land, and each worker was paid about 5 cents a day. Monsieur Oman from the Belgian government came on June 16, 1940 to officially stake out the concession. The buildings went up, and the village women came to smear mud on the walls of the stick buildings. In Lingala, they call it Kobola Potopoto, which loosely means to sling mud. Records show that the ladies received 1 cup of salt as payment for their work. The mission later purchased 25 more hectares, which is about 62 acres. The next people to move to Bato were the Westbergs and Dr. Teddy Johnson in July 1941. Dr. Teddy started the medical work there. I've asked Craig Wickstrom, who spent his formative years at Bato, to share more insights about the station.
Yeah, so Bato is on the edge of one of the largest forested tracts left in Congo. Not far away, there was significant tectonic activity at one time. It left behind some small cliffs and large boulders near what was called Betu, and that missionaries called the Rocks. That was a very popular destination for missionaries. Remember camping out there and just climbing around in the rocks until the military declared it off limits and only used for training.
The water supply was a spring at the bottom of the hill that was pumped to a small concrete tower. This gravity-fed some of the homes, but water was always an issue for both Bato and the nearby villages, as a spring would occasionally dry up. There was a concern for fires, so a firebreak encircled the mission station. It consisted of teak trees that were planted when the station was first built.
Bato had a palm lane, and it ended at the church. On the right was the dispensary or health center, and then to the left, you drove up a hill to where the mission houses were, the missionary houses. And right at the top of the hill was this big Bato tree that Lee Anderson had planted. So it was kind of really made it stand out. And then there were not that many houses. It wasn't a huge mission station in terms of missionary population. But then behind the church, drove around the church and went on behind it, you would come to all of the schools. There was the Bible Institute, and then there was a primary school and a secondary school. And then beyond that were housing dormitories and then housing for the theological student families. And also mixed in with that was some of the workers who maintained the station. Then you went down kind of the other side of that hill and you would find the garage and then the carpentry shop.
So what was the main focus of Bato?
Yeah, when it was started, I'm not sure what the intention was, but it gradually developed into an educational center. And to this day, AMGG, the Ancien de la Mission Bato Bokecha group that's been formed just last year, that everybody that I talk to always mentions the fact that Bato was the premier educational center. And that became the history of Bato, what people remember about it.
It should be noted that the education emphasis developed over time. Before 1960, there was only a primary school. Then a Bible school was added as a sister institution to the Bible school at Kala and taught at a low level. However, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the educational requirements were raised and schools were added and expanded. Quite a few people were added to the staff at Bato as teachers. Bato now includes the Bible Institute, that is essentially a junior college level, a technical school, and 2 secondary schools. Craig has some good memories of his time there.
I lived at Bado during my teen years, and so it kind of felt like home when I look back. I remember those years a little bit better than my earlier years. As a bookworm, I spent a lot of time curled up in a chair reading any books that I could find. But my last 2 years, I had a 22, so I also spent a fair amount of time wandering around hunting for birds and monkeys and antelope. A lot of that time, I was accompanied by a man from the village at Bado who knew the history quite well. And I really enjoyed just listening to his stories about how Bado came about, how it came to be, how it was settled, and so on.
So over time, Bado's ministry focus developed into quality education. This is due to many who taught there, including Craig's dad, Marv Wickstrom, Vanette Thorsell, Clyde Carlson, Clarice Hogberg, and many others too. You will hear more about Vanette, Clyde, and Clarice in future episodes. As Craig mentioned, the high educational standards continue to this day and is touted in the region. During the annual mission conference held March 19th through 26th, 1939 at Kala, with 11 in attendance, Arthur Skoglund got sick and was in bed the last day or two. His illness continued into April and got more serious. It was decided that he and his wife Naomi accompany Dr. Wally Thornbloom to Coquitlam to the hospital there, where they could conduct a more thorough examination. They did diagnostic surgery, and in the short term, he seemed to improve. But the mission felt that he and his wife should return to the U.S. to allow for rest and a full recovery. So Naomi returned to Kala to make the necessary arrangements and packed to return for furlough. She then flew back to Coquitlam to be with Arthur when he made a turn for the worse. She telegrammed back to the Ubangi.
Arthur dying.
Esther London then flew down to be with Naomi during the last days of Arthur's illness. He started to lapse in and out of consciousness, but when awake, he would speak of beautiful things.
Naomi,
he said, clutching for his wife's hand.
I see Gracie Joan, and there are several little Africans who are standing near her, beckoning for me to come. They are so bright and so beautiful.
Recall Gracie Joan was their young daughter who died in June 1936. A short time later, he whispered,
"Goodbye, Naomi. Soon, Daddy and Gracie Joan will be on the other side, beckoning for Mother to come."
Tears flowed from Naomi's eyes as she could not speak. His calm assurance astonished both the doctors and the nurses.
"I can't understand it,"
one Catholic physician said.
"You are so calm, even though you know you're dying."
He managed a thin smile.
"It's victory in death."
That morning, at 11 a.m., he began to sing.
"Wonderful, wonderful, Jesus is to me. Counselor, Prince of Peace, mighty God is he. Saving me, keeping me from all sin and shame. Wonderful is my Redeemer, praise his name."
He got partly through it when the pain increased with such intensity that he could not finish the song, so Naomi did. When the hurting eased a little, he started to sing again.
"Oh, I want to see him, look upon his face, there to sing forever of his saving grace. On the streets of glory, let me lift my voice. Cares all pass, home alas, ever to rejoice."
When he finished the chorus, he closed his eyes and smiled. And at 11:50 a.m., May 3rd, 1939, Arthur Skoglund died. his body was returned to Bolengi near Coquitville, and he was buried. The sixth saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Arthur Skoglund.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Recall that it was a mere 10 days after arriving on the mission field that the Skoglunds had lost their daughter, Grace Joan. Naomi, now a widow, had given up a child and now a husband for the work of spreading the gospel to the Congolese. After a short time in the States after her husband's passing, Naomi returned to Congo and served for many years. She served as a missionary until 1964. What an amazing woman. Blessings on you too, Naomi Skoglund. Bao had been a mission outpost in 1940. It was located northwest of Tandala and east of Kala and Libengi. The topography included mainly grassland with some forest areas nearby. In May 1941, Reverend Erickson, Richard Anderson, and Will Norton did an investigatory trip for establishing new mission stations. They decided to convert the Bao outpost into a mission station. Permission was granted by the government and work started in March 1942. In less than 2 weeks, the workers and villagers erected a chapel, rest house, and a teacher's home. The mission held its dedication on May 17, 1942. 15 hectares, or 37 acres, were formally procured by 1947 to allow for expansion of the station. In 1949, the Congo government offered 50% of the cost for a school, and the mission board supplied the balance. In 1950, a stone church was built by village volunteers, and a medical dispensary was planned. It was 12 years later that the dispensary was finally built. In 1974, the mission and local church asked Joyce Ferguson to open a girls' school at Bao, since she had run one previously. Joyce was on loan from the Regions Beyond Missionary Union mission. In the Congolese society, girls had very little chance to gain an education based on the culture where girls and women were obligated to tend the garden, do all the cooking, and watch the younger children. Joyce had lived adjacent to our house in a camper in Gemena in 1973 through 1974. She shared our refrigerator, and that year our family came to know and love Aunt Joyce. Our family shared so many fun memories with her. She was a character, to say the least. I can't pin down the right adjective to describe her in one word. She had high energy and an amazing personality, and God broke the mold when Joyce was born. She was a total hoot to have around, with lots of fun and laughter. Yet, she was a visionary, practical, had grit, was a maverick, had tons of energy, and rolled up her sleeves to get the job done. Kathleen Birkinshaw, a.k.a. Cookie, lived at Bao and worked there from 1975 to 1987. She worked alongside Joyce for 5 years until Joyce returned to Canada permanently, then continued on as the girls' school director until 1987. She is now retired in Alberta, Canada, and I interviewed her to share about the journey of the school from vision to reality. Joyce knew Cookie in high school, and Joyce influenced her to come to Congo to help start the girls' school. Cookie describes the Bao Mission Station.
There were two missionary houses. They were a lot of Congolese houses, and there was one church at the far end. There was one clinic, we called it a dispensary, and they added surgeries to that. So they were doing C-sections and hernia operations, and there was one primary school. That was considered the Bao Station. We were at Bao for Lycée Lua, but we were actually off of the station, about a five-minute walk. And we were kind of triangular between the airstrip and the station and the school.
The girls' school was called Lycée Lua. Lycée means high school, and Lua was the name of the nearby river. They couldn't have picked a better person for the job to start a school from scratch.
when she was there, they found out that she had been the director at a girls' school. And they begged her to start one in your area, in the Ubongi area. And she had already had a taste for not only the challenge and the necessity of girls' education, but the fruit of it. And so she was willing to do it, even though at that time it seemed like an absolutely impossible undertaking for her.
Joyce had the following dream.
The government wanted her to open a home economics school. And she had a much bigger dream than that. She thought, if it's a boarding school, all the home economics part can be part of extracurricular. But she wanted an academic program so that if a girl chose, she could go as far as possible in her education, even to university. So she flew down to Kinshasa in early July of 1974, and she sat with the education committee and persuaded them that that was the route to take, and they granted her permission.
It initially started with only 7th and 8th grades and eventually went all the way through 12th grade. Joyce set up excellent systems for the school.
5 o'clock in the morning, the kids are up, having breakfast, ready for school by 6. Morning classes up until noon. Then they'd have lunch that was prepared by a cook. And then in the afternoon, they'd have siesta and chores and walk down to the stream, bring back a bucket of water, then have supper and study hall, and then a bit of time just for relaxation and then to bed. And that system worked. And every afternoon, they had the kids divided up into teams. So some doing chores like gathering food for the rabbits. Others were debrushing the area. Some were going to the forest for firewood. A crew would be on supper, another crew on breakfast. And they just rotated every week. So everybody participated, and the system worked.
The structures were all eventually expanded and built of cement brick with tin roofs when Ken and Judy Landrude were there for 4 years as builders. So all the mud and thatch structures were replaced. The school campus is described thusly.
In 1973, when Joyce first looked at it, there was nothing but grassland. And by the time I left in 87, we had 7 or 8 teacher homes at the school. 6 classrooms, 4 dormitories, a dining room, a kitchen, a big building to house rabbits and chickens, and many storage buildings.
While Cookie shared numerous memories of her time at Bow, here is one of her favorites.
It became my home away from home. I never got homesick. I just felt that Bow was where I was to be. It was home. When I was at the school, it was like being in a year-round camp, and I had had so much experience in camp work and had seen the fruit of a week of camp, what it would do for a kid. And we saw that same thing with the girls, and we were like training them to be leaders of their community. I think I added up one time, it was about 400 girls that I worked with during my 12 years. And they ended up going out. Some of them got married and had kids, but they were a community to their, they were a leader to their family.
Joyce Ferguson's life story is in 2 books she authored, titled What's Next? And Now What? She had a vision, tackled the project, and got the job done. Her life's motto was,
I was born for adventure and born again to serve.
I love that approach to life. Joyce passed away in 2019, coincidentally on my birthday. Every birthday henceforth, I'll think of you, Aunt Joyce. I'll always remember her as a special woman and for the example she was to me and my family, and certainly for the school she started, the many girls she taught, and the incredible impact and Christian legacy she left at Bow. There was another property that was secured by the mission about this time. While not a mission station per se, this property became an integral part of the mission's success and culture. In 1939, it is believed Dr. Wally Thornblum visited a lake approximately 12 miles from Kerawa, though no documentation can confirm this. Then, on July 12, 1941, four women from Kerawa embarked on a long day's bike ride and hike to the lake to swim and explore. This is documented. They returned late that night in the rain. Over the next few years, the mission felt that securing a place of rest and recuperation for the missionaries was paramount, and Lake Quatta was designated for that purpose. Considerable work, funding, sacrifice, and sweat equity was expended to create a vacation spot. Harvey Widman built the first mud rest home in 1943. Originally, the mission secured a 10-year ground lease for the property. Several years before the lease was up, the mission purchased the land. Two cement block houses were built initially, followed by two more in the late 1950s. The lake has an interesting history with folklore about a curse causing a village area to sink into the ground and the hole filling with water, creating the lake. The lake is about 1,600 feet long by 1,200 feet wide. It was a beautiful location with warm water, trees, fishing, a tower to jump from, a swing rope, a raft, and other fun water sports. It was rustic, with no running water or electricity, so, quote, glorified camping, unquote, is probably a good description. But ask anybody that spent time at Lake Quatta, and they will respond with wonderful memories. Most missionaries spent several weeks a year there, resting and recharging from their hectic pace of ministry and the difficult tropical climate. You can check out episode 28 on my podcast for a full timeline in history of Lake Quatta, from discovery to securing the property to construction of the four houses and other improvements over many years. Cooperating with the Covenant Church or not cooperating seemed to take a great deal of time during the late 1930s and 40s. But while most relationships and business issues were handled amenably and towards the same goal, there came a time where the differences in mission philosophy came to a head. It was felt by some that the agreement between the two groups, which was signed in 1937, was inadequate. It provided for the transfer of property, the calling of covenant missionaries to Kerawa under the legal umbrella of the Free Church, the liability of the Covenant Church to the government for their missionaries, and the marking of boundaries between the two groups. An agreement was worked out and signed by representatives of the two boards in 1943. A month later, the Free Church missionaries took a look at it and decided it was inadequate. They felt that it was not specific enough in the area of the failure to state the intention of the Covenant Church to seek its own legal charter, and in the matter of boundaries, dividing areas in which each group would work. The only missionary opposing the conclusions of that meeting was Richard Anderson. His voice seemed lost in the fact that he, a Free Church missionary, had announced his engagement to Alpha Almquist, a Covenant missionary nurse. Several attempts were made to resolve the difference between the two groups. A decision was finally reached to divide the two groups. At the conclusion of the discussions, Richard Anderson, who by then was the field superintendent, wrote,
"Since these discussions in committee, our joint conference and our joint efforts in evangelism have been blessed in a special way. The Holy Spirit has in some cases worked in ways which have been truly marvelous. We have marveled at His working in conviction of sin. Besides the spiritual benefit from united action, we can think of the effect upon those among us who are working and of the impression upon those in official circles."
Richard Anderson's hope to keep the two groups together was not to be. The relationship would continue, but the separation of property and the areas was set. This joint enterprise had been looked upon by the CPC, which was the Protestant Council, and others as a happy contrast to those other enterprises which continually split off into factions. As mentioned, the Free Church was officially recognized by the government, and the Covenant Mission was working under this entity. From the beginning, the Free Church missionaries had as their primary goal the building of a strong, viable local church. Thus, they had supported and promoted teacher evangelists as part of the church growth model. In 1940, there were 30 teacher evangelists. In 1945, there were 80, and the church in the Ubangi carried their full support. The mission had been praying for evangelists, but during World War II, they couldn't get the funds from the U.S., so they challenged the national believers to support them. There was some pushback, but Isaac Pelendo in particular said that God would provide what was needed. 3 years earlier, a Bible school had been started for the purpose of training pastors and teacher evangelists so they would eventually be able to take over the work. Planning began in June of 1941, and the foundation was laid in December 1942 at Tandala. And a year later, the school was officially named the Lubangi Bible Institute, or L'Institut Biblique de Lubangi, the acronym IBU. The Covenant Church was asked to cooperate in the school, and they officially agreed to do that in 1945. The missionaries began to work on the equal sharing of financial responsibilities and that of supplying teachers. Then, at the MAU conference in November 1948, it was decided that they did not want to cooperate with the Covenant Church and a school after all. They wanted the Bible Institute to be solely a free church project. On June 5, 1949, the school at Tandala was dedicated. Classes started the next day with 7 students. The school had a 5-year program, which included a year of practical service between the second and third years. Later, a permanent boundary was worked out, and it was concluded that, although the Covenant Church was not formally bound to remain with the Free Church through the legal charter and other agreements, the informal bonds of cooperation and spiritual unity had forged an indissoluble union. The cooperation on the field since that time has proved that the latter assessment was true. The relationship of the missionaries of both groups is one of mutual trust, harmony, and love. When Wallace Thornbloom, also known as Wally, took Jesus as his Savior, he gave his whole life to him for the service of God, no matter where God would take him. He knew that he would be a doctor, so he went to college before going to medical school in Omaha, Nebraska. While he was studying there, Peter Matson, missionary to China, sent him a letter asking if he would agree to go to Africa. He understood at that time that this was God's call for him. In 1934, the Covenant Church called Dr. Thornbloom, along with 3 others, Sarah Westerfield, Florence Nelson, and Axel Ballander, to go to Belgian Congo. Sarah Westerfield, Dr. Thornbloom's fiance, also wanted to follow God's will. Dr. Thornbloom told her,
"You prepare yourself, and God will show you where to serve Him."
Sarah took classes to become a nurse in order to prepare to work alongside her fiance. She was also called to go to Congo in 1934. They went to language school in Belgium and then on to Congo. They were working with the Swedish mission in 1936 when they were married. Their first child, Beverly, was born in Kibunzi in January 1937. On August 7, 1937, Dr. and Mrs. Thornbloom with their daughter Beverly arrived at Karawa. And it was the next day that Karawa Station was transferred to the Covenant Mission from the Evangelical Free Church. Dr. Thornbloom's work began that same day. 6 people showed up for him to help. This was the beginning of many years of helping the people of Congo who were sick in body and sick in their souls. For quite a few years, Dr. Thornbloom was the only doctor for the Covenant Mission in Congo. Everyone, Congolese and missionaries alike, accepted him and Sarah quickly and looked to the Thornblooms for help in many ways. By 1942, they had 3 children, Beverly, Bobby, and Karen, and Sarah was pregnant with their future daughter, Lois. One day in early April, little Beverly became sick. She was weak and had a bad fever. I contacted Lois Thornbloom Sundberg, Beverly's soon-to-be-born sister. Lois describes what happened.
In the paperwork that I read, first of all, Bob and she both had whooping cough, and then she developed, my understanding was that she developed spinal meningitis and malaria, and mm-hmm. they tried to give her quinine to try and bring her temperature down because her temperature was like 106 plus, and they got the temperature down to about 103. With cool baths and such. And then she started having convulsions. And he said that She had more than 26 convulsions. And then after she had passed, Dad did CPR on her for 2.5 hours trying to resuscitate her. And he said she'd come back for a couple of seconds and then she'd slip away again.
As you heard, her body continued to fail, and at 11:45 a.m., she passed away. She was just 5 years and 3 months old. It was April 7th, 1942.
Mom lined the coffin with white silk, and then they dressed her, of course, and put her in this casket.
Missionaries came in from all over to attend the service. The church was decorated with palm fronds and flowers. Many Congolese attended, and Sig Westberg led the service. A lady sang Beverly's favorite song. The local Congolese army sent a few soldiers to stand at attention for the graveside service. She was buried at the Karawa Post Cemetery. So the seventh saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Beverly Thornbloom.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
The Thornbloom family shared several letters with me that were written by Dr. Wally right after Beverly's passing. In those letters, Dr. Wally writes how close his son Bobby was to Beverly and how anguished Bobby was at losing his big sister.
The story I have, anyway, is that he was sent away to like Bado, to a family there to take care of him so that he wouldn't get whatever they thought she had. And he kept saying, but if you had let me stay, she wouldn't have died. Poor kid. He was 4 years old.
Bobby would repeatedly ask,
"Why did Jesus come in to put Beverly Fewitt back in her body? Where is Beverly now?"
While on the field, Dr. Wally was a key leader in the early decades of the mission, helping set up new mission stations, being a key doctor for the entire area, and helping set the course for the mission's growth. Dr. Thornbloom was also a pastor and an evangelist who worked alongside the Congolese leaders and in the churches. Sarah was involved teaching nursing classes to many Congolese and worked in women's ministries impacting many people. Dr. Thornbloom also had an impact on another boy in the U.S. who wanted to be like Dr. Wally. Doug Thorpe, whose dad, Dr. Roger Thorpe, served at Karawa for many years, shares.
He was a huge influence on my father. When my father's mother died and my grandfather remarried a woman that he had known, actually a friend of my original grandmother, from Chicago. And she was a good friend with Sarah. So on one of their furloughs, the Thornblooms went up to the Upper Peninsula to visit my grandparents. And it was harvest time. So the men were all out bringing the harvest and carrying sacks of grain into the barn and up into the storage area and all that. And when the Thornblooms came up, Wally just got in line and gave me a sack I was carrying. And my dad was so impressed, like, who is this man? He's a guest and he shows up and he just falls right in line. You find out, oh, he's a missionary doctor and all that. And he doesn't think he's too good to do hard manual, dirty labor like that. And that made such a strong impression on my dad that was when he first started thinking like, oh, I could do that. I could become a missionary doctor.
After Beverly's passing, Dr. Wally and Sarah had two more children, Lois and Judy. They worked for many years at Karawa, then transferred to Loco in 1966 to start the work of the Paul Carlson Foundation at the hospital. In 1969, Dr. Thornbloom had a heart attack, so they returned to the United States. He passed away in 1982. Sarah passed away in 1990. Their positive impact on the entire mission effort over their years of service is immeasurable. Their legacy continued as their son Bob returned to Congo after college with his wife Jan. Bob and Jan honored his older sister by naming their first daughter Beverly. Bob and Jan were key personnel at the Karawa Mission Station and supported all the Covenant Mission Stations with mechanical and technical support. Bob was also instrumental in providing a water source at Karawa in the mid-1960s, and then in 1984 opening the Zulu Hydroelectric Dam, giving 24-hour electricity to the entire Carowa Mission Station, hospital, and schools. They served their entire careers with the mission until their retirement. While researching for this series, I found a section in the book, Mount to the Sky Like Eagles, by Bernard and Marjorie Palmer that describes a short time period and the incredible illness and medical challenges the missionaries experienced. Here is a direct quote.
At the same time, the missionaries were assaulted with a series of illnesses, most of which were serious. October 31st, 1933, Molly Hansen, who was alone at Kala at the time, suddenly became ill. A special messenger rode in to Tandala on his bicycle, bringing word that she was sick. The next morning, Paul Rozelle went by motorcycle to find out that she was in bed with broken nerves and a fever, most likely brought on by overwork and fatigue. 2 weeks later, a serious yellow fever epidemic broke out. It began in the Bosobolo area, where many people died. One report said 42 people died of the disease in one village in a very short time. The roads were closed to everyone traveling on foot in an effort to stop the spread of the dreaded disease. In December of 1933, Norman Tweed had a bout with malaria and was severely ill. He had three convulsions and was close to death for several days. August 31st, 1934, Erland Rozelle suffered an injury that made it necessary for his parents to take him to Libengi for treatment. When the injury did not heal, they took him to Coquihuatville, where he had to have surgery to correct the problem. Helen Anderson stayed on the field with her two daughters after the death of her husband. Both girls took sick with a hard, bilious fever. In September, Norman Tweed took sick again, running a high fever and having another series of convulsions. He was too weak to go to the doctor, but the doctor came from Libengi and diagnosed the ailment as erysipelas on a leg. It could have been very serious, but it was caught in time. He had to be treated for several weeks afterwards. The same month, Dr. Maas from Gemena removed a blood tumor from Theodore Wallen's lip. The missionary had run a temperature for a long time, apparently caused by the tumor. In November, Norman Tweed again suffered from erysipelas. This time, however, they were able to check it just in time in a few days. Apparently, it was healed.
So as you heard from this short section of the book, disease and illness and the threat of dying was an ongoing challenge for the missionaries and their families serving in Congo. Marian Nelson was born August 14, 1910. She was exposed to missions as a child and was moved to pursue foreign missions. After university to become a teacher, she felt the call at Medicine Lake Bible Camp as the mental picture of helping little black children came to her. She prepared that next year and in early 1940 embarked for Africa. She served for 3 years, teaching and serving faithfully, but unfortunately her health caused her to return to the U.S. for furlough and recuperation. In one of her letters, she wrote,
"Oh, so many times I have gotten so homesick for heaven, and I have just longed to see my Jesus face to face. So I have wished I could go fast and soon."
Well, we now know that God planned her trip home as she hoped. She left Africa for furlough on a ship. This ship was the SS Bescholt, which had just a few days prior brought Harvey and Ruth Widman to Congo. Their trip had taken 40 days. The Widmans had befriended Captain Longefos and had dinner one evening with him, some other friends, and Marion. At dinner, Marion posed the question of gaining passage on the ship to return to the United States. The captain replied that it was very dangerous due to the Germans. Remember, this is during World War II. Marion responded,
"Do I look like I am afraid?"
The Bescholt boasted 28 crew and 14 passengers, displacing 5,000 tons and was 420 feet long. It was transporting copper, tin, and palm oil headed for New York via Trinidad. 9 days into the voyage, all of a sudden, at 10:05 p.m., German submarine U-174 launched two torpedoes at the ship. Nothing. Both were duds or missed. An hour or so later, at 11:17 p.m., the submarine broke surface again and launched another G-7 torpedo. This one hit. One account notes, quote, "the port side was blown to smithereens," unquote. Many made it to two lifeboats that survived the torpedo. One guy got eaten by a shark before he made it to the lifeboat. The ship split in half and sank in 2 minutes. One lifeboat did make it 800 nautical miles to the coast of Brazil and was rescued a week or two later. Another lifeboat was picked up by a passing freighter. One of the survivors later told a Covenant missionary that after the torpedo hit, Marion was going down the rope ladder on the side of the ship, and the first mate went up to help her. As the ship sank, they were both sucked down into the water and drowned. In total, 14 of the 42 on board perished, and Marion was unfortunately among those. She was just 32 years old. It was December 2, 1942. She was loved by many, and the comments reflecting her life talked about a servant's heart, being a good student who strived for excellence, and who gave of her time and talents to everyone. It was exactly 1 month later, January 2, 1943, that a cablegram reached Kerawa. It read,
"Ship torpedoed by enemy submarine. Sank immediately. All lives presumed lost, including Marion Nelson."
A memorial service was held for her at Kerawa in September 1943, and Sakofio, the Congolese school principal where she taught, quoted Revelation 20:13.
"For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved."
Sakofio expressed confidence that he and the Christian schoolboys had of seeing their beloved teacher again, because, he said,
"the sea gave up the dead which were in it."
Another pioneer of the mission work had given her life for the call to serve in Africa, this time at sea. The eighth saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Marion Nelson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Covenant Tabernacle Church in Minneapolis, where Marion was a member, later sent money to build a church at Kerawa in her memory. The Kerawa congregation consecrated the building in her name in 1951. I attended that church most of my growing up years from 1965 until 1980, when I lived at Kerawa or was attending the Ubangi Academy boarding school. This church is still standing and has three services each Sunday, even now, in 2026. Now, in the mid-1940s, the mission realized that while they were doing a good job throughout the Ubangi region with education and schools, having literature for the Congolese was another important aspect of building the church. The Congo Protestant Council, or CPC, proposed establishing a central printing press to serve all the Protestant missions in producing literature. The mission had benefited from its small, hand-operated press starting back in 1934, when a songbook was printed along with some other materials. But it was slow, time-consuming, and not efficient. The missionaries were interested, and after 3 years, LECO was started. This was the acronym for Librairie Évangélique au Congo. This new source of literature, songbooks, and other Christian materials was a huge boost to the effort. After opening his practice, Dr. Titus Johnson's reputation for having a caring approach to his patients' needs, both physical and psychological, helped his practice grow quickly. His financial resources grew, allowing him to make good investments and support mission efforts and other students in need. With his newfound financial resources, his need for adventure and travel became a reality, and he took many long and exciting trips all over the world. He settled into a life of money, fine dining, concerts, and social events, being a doctor and living a good life in Chicago. He was busy with his practice, but he did stay connected with Congo missionaries and supported many others. He had met a lady named Agnes Olson. Soon a romance developed, and on August 12, 1943, they were married. Though Agnes worked at the Covenant Mission headquarters, and Titus assumed she felt the same about Congo, that was not to be. It was not a good match. Yet, in 1946, the call came to return to Congo to cover for Dr. Wally Thornblum at Karawa while he was on furlough. Would he?
Yes.
February 7th, 1947 was the farewell and send-off service for Dr. Titus and Agnes to go to Congo. A 15-week course in Belgium for tropical medicine ensued, and then a brief internship, and by August, he was back in Congo. Things had changed in the 21 years he'd been gone, culturally, politically, educationally, and physically, with numerous missionaries on the field and many buildings built and operational. His medical practice in Chicago was a far cry from the incredible medical issues he faced at the Karawa Hospital. Yet, he worked hard, adapted, and became efficient in diagnosis and surgery. He traveled to other mission stations and did hundreds of surgeries. The medical need was huge. Agnes jumped in to help in any way she could with her medical background and other skills. They spent 14 months in Congo. Ruth Robinson and her husband Bob got married in 1943 after college in Chicago. Ruth was known for her musical talent, in which she could play the organ very well. Less than a year later, Bob and Ruth were in the Belgian Congo. They were stationed at Tandala. While on the field, she became pregnant. A few weeks before delivery, Bob and Ruth went to Karawa to be at the hospital for the birth. During this time, she wrote a letter to her mother and stated,
"We are getting kind of impatient sitting here in Karawa, awaiting for our precious bundle of love to arrive, while we think of all the work waiting for us in Tandala."
This reflects that the mission work was on her heart above everything. Shortly before delivery, she suffered a convulsion. This was soon followed by 10 more, before the baby, named Robert Marshall Robinson, was born at 8:40 p.m. After a difficult delivery, Ruth was in a severe state, such that she couldn't even see her new son that the nurse brought to her. She was experiencing what we now know as eclampsia. They let the baby touch her cheek, and Ruth murmured,
"Oh, I can't believe it."
Those were her last words as she slipped into unconsciousness. She had a few more convulsions before going unconscious and contracting pneumonia. Her fever rose to 106 degrees. Injected with penicillin and surrounded by bags of ice helped bring her temperature down. Yet, after 3 days of being tended to by Dr. Wally Thornblum, Ruth passed away at 1:15 p.m. She was only 22 years old. It was Thursday, July 25, 1946. A casket was made with blue and white cloth lining it. They placed a corsage on her dress and a flower in her hair, and she was described as though she was sleeping. The funeral was the next day in the church, followed by a graveside service. She was buried at Karawa. A memorial service was held at her home church in Chicago, October 13, 1946. Will Norton and Dr. Wally Thornblum spoke at the service. So the ninth saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Ruth Robinson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Bob Robinson, now a widower, had a little infant. Little Bobby was initially taken care of by Naomi Skoglund at Kala, quite a distance from Tondala. After 3 or 4 months, Bob was missing his little boy so much, he asked Liz Anderson if she'd take care of him so he could be with him. Liz took him in. Liz describes him thusly.
What a beautiful baby, a little fatty with dimples all over, very big dark eyes, and lots of smiles. We were able to find a very good caretaker, Lombo, to care for him when I was at work. Also, Dorothy and Jean were great in sharing responsibilities for him. Bobby's presence did a lot to heal the deep wounds in Bob's heart. How he loved that little guy.
Jean Lindblad was one of the nurses, and she moved in with Liz Anderson to help take care of little Bobby. A relationship between Bob and Jean began to blossom, and it was about 9 months later, in August 1947, that they married. Bob and Jean served at Tondala and then some time at Bow. Bob and Jean then had a son together named Richard in 1948. After several years, they left the Free Church Mission and joined Africa Inland Mission and moved to Aba in eastern Congo, where the borders of Congo, South Sudan, and Uganda meet. They had 2 more sons, and the children all attended Rift Valley Academy in Kenya. Bob and Jean taught at the Bible school there for many years until September 1970, when Bob had a heart attack. Jean continued on alone, teaching at the Bible school until her retirement. I was able to contact Bob Robinson, the baby born to Ruth in 1946, to discuss his mother and how his dad and family moved on. We talked on the phone, and he shared that he was also researching information on his birth mother, Ruth. He shared that in researching Ruth's background, he discovered her personality and interest were very similar to that of Jean, his stepmother. Also, he didn't know that Jean was his stepmother until he was in college. When Jean passed away in November 2011, he offered the following tribute to his 2 moms. He said,
"Ruth gave me life at the cost of her own. Jean taught and showed me how to live it."
Bob became a pastor and served at several churches, including a 6-year stint in Guatemala as a missionary during his career. He is now retired in Wisconsin. At the Free Church Missions semi-annual conference, October 1945, it was decided that the choice of expansion mission sites be made. This led to scheduling several survey trips. 3 trips were made over the course of the next year or so. None of the areas seemed good candidates, and the report of the second trip noted, quote, "No suitable site was found. Mosquitoes were abundant throughout most of the likely areas," unquote. A 3rd survey trip into the Covenant Field in the Bosobolo Territory happened in December of that year. 6 men were on that survey trip, and a spot just south of the village of Bokata was selected. A few months later, on February 1, 1946, at the annual conference of the Free Church, they formally decided to establish a mission station at Bokata. This would be located about halfway between the 2 state territorial centers, Bosobolo and Libengi. The chief of the Bokata area people, Pongbo, was eager that Protestants start work among his people. He approved of the site chosen, which was at the top of a hill, and on May 7, 1947, Elmer Pearson and Wisamo Gabriel, head evangelist, came to begin the work. On August 12th, the mission boundaries were worked out by a state official and Elmer Pearson. It would occupy 216 acres. The Bokata station was from the beginning meant to be an evangelistic outpost, and this emphasis remained primary. The station was established in a dark area. Witchcraft and belief in evil spirits were strong. Medical work was begun in 1949 by Dr. Teddy Johnson after a survey in the fall of 1948 revealed the medical needs. The Pearsons and Lee and Aline Anderson were at Bokata initially. It had 2 houses, a carpenter shop, and 3 temporary buildings. These included a church, school, and dispensary. These buildings were of mud and stick construction. Harvey and Ruth Widman followed the Andersons there and served 8 years there. An interesting story is shared by Harvey and Ruth Widman. Their house had a mudded ceiling as opposed to a woven bamboo mat ceiling. One night, Ruth woke up to a strange crackling sound. She shook Harvey and said,
"Quick! Put your pillow over your head!"
She had no more gotten her pillow over her own head when down came the ceiling. Huge mud chunks that would have injured them for sure or given them a royal headache. Apparently, the termites had eaten the sticks and then gave way to the weight of the mud ceiling, and down went the ceiling. Several years later, permanent buildings were built for the missionary staff, including homes, dispensary, church, and houses for the Congolese staff. I've asked Sandy Widman Bernal, Harvey and Ruth's daughter, who spent 7 years there during her childhood, to explain the mission campus.
There was a dispensary with a sterile room for operating, because Dr. Theodora Johnson was the doctor stationed with us, and she was able to perform operations that needed it. You know, super serious things would have to be taken to care of. The church was built by Kelly Edstrom. I think all the houses were built by Kelly Edstrom, if I'm not mistaken.
There was a spring nearby to provide clean water. They built a small concrete box around the spring head and had pipes protruding for filling up jugs for hauling to the homes for drinking water. For domestic water for sinks and toilets, they had a well with a pump that filled a water tower, which in turn gravity fed the water into the homes. Reports I read were that the pump wasn't very dependable, so months at a time would go by without running water in the homes. The Widmans also dammed up the stream to form a lake. This lake was used for recreational swimming and baptismal services. Sandy talks about the lake.
It had two tunnels going through it, one at the top and one at the bottom. The one at the bottom was when they needed to completely drain the pool and clean it. And that happened, I guess, periodically. The upper tunnel was for overflow. The dam was wide enough you could drive a car over it if you needed to. And they did clear land around the pool, the jungle around it, so that you didn't have to worry about snakes, you know, coming up. Although every time we went to the pool, we carefully looked over the pool to make sure no snakes were swimming in it or slithering around the banks of the pool, so people could swim in safety.
The lake is also where Harvey Widman planted tilapia fish, creating a fish pond. They drained the lake periodically to harvest the fish. Many years later, in the late 1960s, Harvey relocated some of the tilapia minnows from Bocara to Loco to help start their fish pond program. Another interesting factoid is that while most mission stations had a palm lane entry, Bocara had teak trees instead, lining the main road into the station. Sandy shares about the ministry focus of Bocara.
Education, medicine. Kay Sunstrand came later and was in charge of the education part of it.
Here's another interesting story.
The other thing I remember is the Mau Mau. They were like a terrorist group going through Africa. And I do remember one night they were close in the area. And I remember Dad taught my mother how to use his rifle. And she sat up all night with the rifle guarding us kids in the house. They were that close. Fortunately, they never came.
In November 1952, the Bocara station was host to the first Ubangi Regional Conference. Someone procured a silver travel trailer that they used when having village evangelism trips, thus allowing the person to stay for multiple days in the trailer for lodging. This trailer was used all throughout the area and eventually ended up at Karawa in the early 1970s, a great tool that was used for village work. By 1956, there were 1,286 church members and 37 teacher evangelists serving in many villages. The schools had 760 enrolled students. So indeed, a successful mission outcome, as its purpose was to be an evangelistic outreach post. As previously mentioned, communication during this time was hard, delayed, and not efficient. Runners, bicycles, and sometimes a truck had to be sent to relay messages. Medical emergency information was a challenge between stations. In 1947, the Mission Committee recommended getting radios for communication between mission stations. Mr. Casebolt from Richmond, California, donated 2 shortwave radios to be used at Kala and Tandala. Additional permits were applied for and granted to populate each station with radios, and by 1948, 2 other stations were set up. The first transmission was from Kala on May 13, 1948. On Sunday, December 12, 1948, with 6 radios, the interstation radio communication system was dedicated. During the next year, the radio communication system began to prove its worth. Messages concerning illness brought medical help within hours. Meetings were held to discuss and decide about urgent problems, and announcements of interest to all were given immediate dissemination. And once Mission Aviation Fellowship had a plane flying around the area in the 1960s, having communication to send the pilot weather reports, etc., was critical for the mission operations. Each station was given a radio call number to identify it. Gemina was 91, Karawa was 92, Tandala was 94. Our family was located at Gemina from 1973 through 1990. And being the hub that it was, that radio was constantly a fixture in our living room, as my mom was the operator for Gemina. Radio business covered all sorts of things. Here's a typical radio conversation.
91 to 94, over.
94 here, over.
Yes, Jeff Eels is reporting that sacks of flour just arrived in the store here in Gemina. He asked the store owner to hold 15 sacks for him, so please send in how many you'd like to have him buy. Over.
Wow, that's great. He's the best. We're all down to about 1 week's worth of flour, so have him buy 5 sacks for us. And oh, tell Jeff that I'll make him a batch of cookies with that flour next time he comes over to Tandala. Over.
91 here. Copy that. 5 sacks of flour for Tandala. Hang on. Jeff says he's planning to be there next week. Make them chocolate chip. Over and out.
So having daily radio contact between mission stations for updates, weather reports, airplane schedules, medical issues, and general business of operating the mission was a key advancement for the mission effort. In conclusion of the second episode in the series, we took the listener from the 3 established mission stations and the mission's desire for expansion. Also, there were those people that gave their lives in the process: Arthur Skoglund, Beverly Thornbloom, Marion Nelson, and Ruth Robinson. Rest in peace, all. The loss of one spouse or child was difficult for every family on the field. Certainly, each person questioned the cost of serving in Congo to be a part of the pioneering mission effort. But all these saints will be remembered and rewarded and rejoined with their families one day. Thanks to Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester for forwarding considerable materials from the Free Church Archives, including books, articles, and letters to help put this episode together. The list of document acknowledgments is very long, so I will do so at the conclusion of the final episode. Thanks also to Craig Wickstrom, Cookie Birkinshaw, and Sandy Widman Bernal for sharing their insights about Bato, Bao, and Bocata. Also, Lois Thornbloom Sundberg for sharing the family memories of her sister Beverly's passing. I also extend thanks to Anthony and Juliana Shea and the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help bring the stories to life. In the next episode of this 7-part series, we will present the period of 1948 to 1952 of our mission work in the northwest corner of Congo. In episode 3, you will hear about the identification and procurement of more mission stations and the unfortunate loss of several children and adults that passed away. And the need to educate the missionary children became an issue, so how the school was started and then almost shut down will be shared. Also, the missionaries begin to transition leadership to the Congolese about this time, and it doesn't go quite according to plan. Thank you for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the next episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eales, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikalamalamu. My friends, stay well.